This afternoon, we're going to have a seminar on the problems and perspectives of the American Revolution. And the speaker, or the lead-off speaker, will be James P. Cannon, who's an old-time socialist, the founder of the Socialist Workers Party, and the past national chairman of the Socialist Workers Party. Now, there will be certain questions that he will not answer, and certain ones that he will, and he'll decide this as he goes along. But right now, start off with Governor Cannon.
He should have said, "I'll answer if I can." I want to begin by explaining this delay of 15 minutes that I was here strictly on the dot of 2:30. According to the Bolshevik custom of being on time, and any delay was due to extraneous circumstances which I will not mention. In order to spare the feelings of the delinquents who've got to face the Control Commission and explain why we're not you not ready on time. According to the Bolshevik custom, Lenin and Trotsky were great sticklers for being on time. I had a chance to observe that personally in my visits to Trotsky with the delegations several times in Mexico City, when he used to have sessions something like this with the delegation from New York and Minneapolis, and all the guards and other comrades doing technical work were invited. When the hour came to begin the seminar, Trotsky would get up and ostentatiously lock the door if anybody was absent, so that when they come, they would have to knock and be reprimanded for being late. Bolshevism, in a way, is a synonym for efficiency and timeliness. They were on time for the revolution in 1917. Lenin once said, "A man who doesn't know how to show up on time is like a fella who comes late for a wedding and finds a funeral in progress and goes around wishing everybody present many happy returns of the day." You have wrought a miracle today. I made my first soapbox speech on the corner of 6th and Main Street in Kansas City 61 years ago. I had a little stage fright and nervousness before I started. But after the first few minutes, I got over it. And from that time to this, according to my calculation, I've made about 15,000 speeches. And I never had a trace of stage fright in any one of them until today. Rose can testify I've been quite nervous, because it's a new experience for me. This is the first seminar that I ever presided over or ever attended, as a matter of fact. The only time I went to college was like the thief who said, "Sure, I've been to college. I ran across a campus two jumps ahead of the sheriff." Good. Now, the purpose of the seminar, as we have discussed it and outlined it, is not a call to action, although we are a party of action. It's not an appeal for efficiency, although we pride ourselves on our efficiency. That's one of the ingredients of our party. It's rather an attempt to stimulate thought about new things in America and the world. Because without thought, brought up to date all the time, efficiency in action often turns into what has been called all motion and no direction. The party is not only an efficiency machine and an action machine, but first of all and above all, it's a thinking machine. That's what distinguishes us from many others. I thought the good way to begin on the general subject of what it means to be a young socialist today and the perspectives before him to discuss it in connection with what it meant to be a young socialist when Rose and I were your age, young, more than 50 years ago. That was still the Victorian age, although the Queen was dead. But the general atmosphere and attitude of the people, especially in the Anglo-Saxon world, was Victorian. That was the atmosphere of confidence and optimism in steady, increasing progress, step by step to unlimited goals without any interruptions. When the theory of evolution, both social and organic, was conceived of as a steady, slow progress and improvement, without taking note of the fact that in organic evolution, as propounded by Darwin, and social evolution, as propounded by Marx and Engels, takes note of the fact that at various stages in the gradual evolution there are violent explosions which are known as revolutions, which transform the situation fundamentally and then go on evolving further until there's another revolution, or in some cases a counter-revolution. Now, before the First World War, to be a socialist, above all, meant to be committed to an idea and an ideal which one served without any ability to demonstrate concretely that you were engaged in a practical task. One of the most effective arguments that used to be made against us 50-odd years ago was, it's a good idea, but we'll never live to see it. Or it can be done. The workers won't move. Look at them, how apathetic they are. Nowhere in the world have the workers ever won any real victories. The most they ever won was a few cents more an hour. And we couldn't refute that from practical experience. And we couldn't refute from practical evidence the theory that things were just going to continue as they were, but getting a little better from day to day and year to year. So why get excited, even if you're a socialist? You go to a meeting, like a religious person goes to Sunday school once a week. And the rest of the week you devote to practical affairs and prepare for the future, to raise a family and look forward to grandchildren and great-grandchildren who eventually someday or other will live in a socialist society. There was peace in the world. The great powers had not been in conflict in a military way since 1870. And it looked like this peace was stable and permanent. And then into this idyllic picture of slow, steady progress came the thunderbolts of the First World War, 1914, exactly 50 years ago this week. And then Rosa Luxemburg reminded people that we have always said, when we said socialism is inevitable, we always coupled it with the assertion socialism or barbarism is the perspective of the human race. And this world war is barbarism, where the old slogan, workers of the world unite, has been transformed into socialists and union workers in different countries murdering each other in the service of the masters. And the First World War took a toll of between 10 and 20 million dead and innumerable wounded and starved and deprived in various ways. And after the First World War, then we had the terrible depression. And then we had the Second World War, which cost between 20 and 40 million human lives and innumerable casualties, wounded in various ways. And then we had the horror of 6 million people, men, women, and children in Germany and Poland and other Nazi-occupied places being murdered in gas chambers. And we had the unspeakable horror of Stalin's slave labor camp. And we had the unmentionable crime of a whole city full of people in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki destroyed with a single moment with the first atomic bomb. So things at the end of the First World War were somewhat different. They were in the idyllic days prior to 1914. And it was the obligation of Marxists, who above all are thinkers, whose theory, as Engels said, is a theory of social evolution, whose theory, he said, is not a dogma to be repeated by rote, but a guide to action. And the First World War ended in 1945 with Europe and Japan and a large part Eastern Europe and Russia in ruins and America triumphant with a monopoly of the atomic bomb and a minimum of casualties and an abundant prosperity made by supplying goods to the other countries who had sacrificed so many millions in the war. And it was then that a great genius named Henry Luce, the proprietor of Lifetime and Fortune, came out with a jubilant editorial, waving it over the ashes of the victims of the gas chambers and the battlefields and the slave labor camps, and proclaim the American century. America was to rule the world as Rome did in her time. But what does it look like today? I have a grandson, and I told him about this fact that the American century had been proclaimed in 1945. Now, what does that prove? And he, with a sense of humor and being a good straight man, said, "I don't know. What does it prove?" And I said, "It proves that some centuries are shorter than others." But 1945 seems ions and ions away. What's happened since 1945 is what we, as Marxists, students of social reality, which does not remain constant but changes, have to do our thinking about. Marx, in his introduction to the first volume of Capital, said what he had undertaken to prove by his exhaustive examinations and his writings was that human society is not a solid crystal, but an organism subject to change and constantly changing. And our task in the present hour and in the days that lie ahead is to assess what has changed since 1945 and adjust our thinking and consequently our perspective accordingly. Since 1945, prostrate Europe has risen again, first with American help in order to dispose of their surplus capital, and as a protection against the Soviet Union, which incidentally and most inconsiderately in the meantime had developed the atomic bomb of their own and destroyed the American monopoly. That's point one. America no longer has the monopoly of atomic weapons or of rockets, and it's very doubtful if we are to judge by the demonstrations that have taken place in space whether we have as accurate and deadly rockets as the Soviet Union had. Europe has grown from a colony, a dependent colony of the United States, to a great industrial power, more or less united in the European Economic Community, and a bitter competitor of the United States in the world market. Japan has risen from the ashes to become a competitor in the world market. The Soviet Union and the Eastern European countries associated with it have also enormously increased their productive capacity. And then, out of a clear sky, as far as the blind were concerned, came the Chinese Revolution, in which 600 to 700 million people not only chased the American satrap Chiang Kai-shek off the mainland and brought about a complete social revolution in China, but also at the same time closed China to the world capitalist market, as Russia and Eastern Europe had already been closed. And then China triggered the further colonial revolutions in Korea, Vietnam, I just don't know just how things are in South Vietnam right now, but yesterday they didn't look so good. Yesterday I read the mobs were in the streets and that the latest savior had been replaced by a triumvirate. And we're going in there to defend free people. We have trouble locating where they are. The South Vietnamese think they must be somewhere else. They're certainly not in Saigon because they're storming the headquarters of the custodians of their freedom. And the Chinese Revolution triggered the colonial revolution throughout Asia and Africa, and finally, against our best wishes, leaped across the wide ocean to Cuba and is fermenting all over Latin America. And in the meantime, American productivity is growing at an astonishing rate, but the market in the world is narrowing. Can't sell goods to Russia, to Eastern Europe, or to China, except on a quid pro quo basis. You can't sell goods to Europe, except on an exchange basis. The narrowing market with the increasing production raises the question for any Marxist of a point at which overproduction, which was foreseen by Marx more than 100 years ago, will attack all the capitalist countries, not with a depression such as we knew in 1929 until the beginning of the Second World War, but nobody knows of how great consequences. And then in the midst of this dilemma, when all the economists are scratching their heads and saying, as I read them, they're not asking when is going to come the recession. They mean the depression or the crisis. To complicate things further, they have developed something new which greatly increases the productivity of the system while decreasing the manpower required. Automation, or as some of the scientists want to call it, cybernation. That is automatic machinery coupled to computers which do the thinking and directing, displaces men faster than the increased demand for goods can keep up with. We know a few rough facts, for example, that in the coal mines, two-thirds of the people who made their living traditionally by coal, as their fathers did before them and their grandfathers, two-thirds of the coal miners have been removed from the mines to make room for machines to dig coal. The same thing is happening in the packing houses, which touches me emotionally because my first job was in a packing house. All the great plants in the big centers have not been remodeled. They've just simply been torn down and moved out to the centers where the cattle are fattened, in where they are processed by automated plants, and probably a half of the packing house workers, skilled, semi-skilled, and half-skilled, are roaming the streets of their old haunts without jobs, without a chance to get. Already we have an increasing unemployment They say 5 million, but the true figure is probably 10 million, as all the honest experts tell you, because the other 5 million consists of people who've quit looking for jobs. 5 million are those they have registered. I've read in a dozen places, I'm not an expert on the question, but I've been reading rather voluminously lately in discussing with comrades the increasing abundance of literature that's pouring out on the effectiveness of automation and cybernation. One figure that seems to be generally agreed upon, that every week 40,000 jobs are eliminated in the industry right now. That's 2 million a year. And now we're reaping the full benefit of the baby boom following the First World War, and 2 million surplus babies have become teenagers looking for work that they can't find. And the rate of employment among young, vigorous teenagers, dropouts from high school or graduates makes no difference, who can't find jobs. And among the Negroes, it runs to 30-40% of young adolescents. While the Negro people have been apparently, on the surface, making advances by their newfound militancy, and by the way, that's new. That's less than 10 years old. Less than 10 years old. That is the self-assertion of the Negro people outside the framework of the ultra-respectable and reformistic National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Broken out of that in various forms and made a few gains and a few laws. But the condition of the Negro people have actually worsened year by year while they were fighting hardest and making the most apparently important gains on the legal field. And you hear about the riots in Harlem, in Brooklyn, in Rochester, Chicago, yesterday in Philadelphia. These are riots for the most part triggered by young adolescent Negroes who have no jobs, can't find jobs. And out of their frustration and their desperation and the brutality inflicted upon them by police, take to the streets in violent action. They don't gain anything, or at least they haven't gained anything yet, except a promise to confer between the leaders. All the leaders of the various organizations that have sprung up within 10 years all are against that and try to solve it by negotiation, and they no sooner get a meeting to negotiate with the masters of what they call the power structure, which they ought to call American capitalism, in order to call things by their right name, a riot breaks out in Philadelphia. Nobody knows where the next thing. And the significant thing is that we are only at the beginning of the automation revolution. They just got started. And it's self-propelling and developing to the point where a group of thinkers, none of whom calls themselves socialists, financed by, and this is the magnificent irony of the whole thing, Committee for the Study of Democratic Institutions, financed by the Ford Foundation, comes out with a document on the Triple Revolution in which they document the strides already made by cybernation and extrapolate from that as thinkers should, to distinguish the trend into the future, and they come to the conclusion that there's no possibility, not merely of assimilating the present 10 million unemployed, not to speak of the 15 million elderly people who are poor, living on the ragged edge of nothing, but that there will be so many millions more that they will have, if they want to keep their system going, they're going to have to abandon the whole idea of wages for work performed, because there will not be sufficient work, and that they will have to introduce the system of everybody who's born into this world being entitled to compensation equivalent to a comfortable living, whether he works or not. And this is the document that's been laid on the table for the consideration of the Marxists, who, I'm sorry to say, didn't think of it first. But I would be sorrier still to say that some Marxists, because the original thinking began from other sources, were not flexible and subtle and intelligent enough to seize upon the evidence provided by them and make our own extrapolations as to what the perspective is. Now, the perspective, as I see it, is that this can't go on, because it is not only the cyber nation or automation revolution is not merely taking place in the United States, it's already well underway in Europe and Japan and the Soviet Union. And America will, in my opinion, in the very near future, run up against the fact that the world market is so flooded with goods that they'll have to slow down production, because for some peculiar reason, they don't produce goods for the fun of it. They don't produce goods for utility, or for beauty, or just for the hell of it. They produce goods for profit, and in order to get profit, they got to sell them. And where in the hell are they going to sell them when the market is clogged, not only by our overproduction, but by that of Europe and Japan and the Soviet Union? Now, I don't see any possible solution for this except a tremendous showdown and a modification of the early formula of the socialists of the post-Marxist time, who said socialism or barbarism. Because there has been another revolution taking place alongside the automation revolution, and that's the revolution in weaponry, as the ad hoc committee called it. That's the development of atomic, nuclear, hydrogen bombs, and the means to deliver them any place on Earth, until you hear the proud boast of the representatives of the military and the government, that we already have enough nuclear bombs and the means to deliver them any place on Earth. We already have enough to kill every man, woman, and child 4 or 5 times over. That's what they call overkill. And then there's the sobering second statement, the Soviet Union's got a lot of these bombs too. And when they talk about a confrontation with the Soviet Union, they say, as if they were discussing a game of chess, I heard McNamara say, and I heard Kennedy say it before them. They said, we have the means to destroy the Soviet Union and China, but they have the means to kill 100 million Americans at the same time within the first hour, only the first try. And I think when they say 100 million, they mean 200 million. There exists not only the possibility, but the danger. As long as American imperialism has its command of this capacity to destroy the human race, whether by direct firepower, firestorms, or by subsequent fallout of strontium 90, while they have all that, there is no security whatever in this world. And here I would like to make a slight correction of a remark made by the speaker last night, where he spoke of the colonial revolution. Where is the center of the international revolution? I remarked to a seatmate, he should have said at the present moment. Because the colonial revolution can't disarm the American imperialists. Neither can the Soviet Union. They can only deter them. The only ones who can disarm the American imperialists and their arsenal of death-dealing hydrogen and atomic bombs is the American working class. And if they don't do it, you're in yearly, monthly, weekly, daily, hourly danger. Not only you, the whole world is in danger of an accident or an insane person in one of the submarines deciding it's time to put an end to all this foolishness and to defoliate some of these jungles with a couple of nuclear weapons, which will bring retaliation because there'd be no way of knowing who fired them or where they come from, and the world can be consumed in an atomic holocaust. Now, how long can this last? Our international resolution, the dynamics of world revolution, which is one of the very best documents of our international movement, fully worthy, in my opinion, in succession to the great documents produced by Trotsky, analyzes the whole world problem, and I think essentially correctly, and comes to the conclusion, which is obvious to any thinking person, that there cannot be any final showdown until it takes place in the United States. Until the American imperialists are disarmed. And they cannot be disarmed from without, only from within. And they say by the end of the century, the American working class will complete its historic mission. Now, I would like to end my preliminary summation by saying my difference with them is time. I agree with that document, and I admire it enormously, but I think they are too optimistic on the time span they allow. I think it would be more realistic to say 10 years, that we've got 10 years in this country to decide whether this terrible risk is going to be continued or whether the American working class is going to disarm the American imperialists and scrap the nuclear weapons and clear the road for a socialist world. And that gives, to come back to our point of departure, to a young socialist today, as different from our time, 50-odd years ago, it gives to their work a sense of urgency. That when you join the socialist movement consciously and understandingly, with a knowledge of the basic premises of Marxism, brought up to date and applied to these new problems, which are not fabricated by me, but which are known to all, or should be known to all, because they're printed every day more and more. Since I began to think and discuss this question a year ago with comrades in L.A., never a week goes by that we don't get some new information about some new advance of the tremendous potential of the destructiveness of the nuclear arsenal on the one side and the increased productivity of the automated machinery at the expense of human labor power on the other, that we have to come to the conclusion there's a shorter time. So that when you join the socialist movement now, you're joining the battle which in your own lifetime, not your children, not your grandchildren, but in your own lifetime, and even before you reach an advanced age, is going to be settled, and you have got to be the vanguard of the people that are going to settle. So that being a socialist becomes the central purpose of your life and your activity, and that everything you do counts. However little it may signify at the moment, whether it's to write a leaflet or distribute a leaflet or to make a speech or attend a meeting or take part in a demonstration, or, no less important and perhaps more important, gather occasionally in seminars or lectures to discuss and above all to think. And in thinking, a true Marxist does not discard any element of reality. And the essence of Marxist politics is not only to begin with reality as it is, but also as it has evolved from the past, and as it is in evolving toward the future, and always looking to see what's new and what does it signify for us. So the essence of my presentation is, let's have a consideration, a sort of a think session among ourselves. What's new? How is it related to the past? What are we going to do about it today? And what does it signify for our own lives as young revolutionists just beginning to go into action?